From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, a US presidential debate viewed from China, a close-up of a death in Syria, and a little-known vintage from France. America's presidential debates have long inspired debate parties and media coverage that brings American voters together to offer their impressions. NPR recently expanded that idea and invited 8 people in China to watch the second presidential debate at our bureau in Shanghai. Perhaps not surprisingly, the candidates' comments on relations with China generated the strongest response, as NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
Our panel ranged in age from 24 to 40. All were college-educated, working white-collar jobs here in downtown Shanghai. More than half favored President Obama. They cited his more populist tone and less confrontational stance towards China. While some admired Governor Romney's business smarts, they felt some of his criticisms of China were political and overblown. They cited this one.
On day one, I will label China a currency manipulator, which will allow me as president to be able to put in place, if necessary, tariffs where I believe that they are taking unfair advantage of our manufacturers.
Do not try to find any scapegoat.
Alex Scher works as an administrator in a manufacturing company. He says America's economic problems are huge, homegrown, and unrelated to his country's currency.
Just try to put your own fiscal house in places. Try to look into your own province.
Chinese viewers also singled out this comment by the former Massachusetts governor.
What I will do as president is make sure it's more attractive to come to America again. This is the way we're going to create jobs in this country. Now, we're going to have to make sure that as we trade with other nations, that they play by the rules. And China hasn't.
My name is Stella Xie. I work for the China Economic Review as a researcher.
Xie says Mr. Romney seems to blame China for the nature of globalization, low-wage jobs migrating to low-wage countries.
I mean, in the past, like, U.S. has these issues over manufacturing job with Japan and with other, like, Asian countries. So they have a, you know, argument with China at this point. But, like, maybe 10 years later, they have this same issue with Vietnam, with Cambodia, as these jobs shift from China, you know, out to other countries.
Governor Romney did hit home with U.S. domestic issues that also resonate here in China, including this one.
Well, what you're seeing in this country is 23 million people struggling to find a job. And a lot of them, as you say, Candy, have been out of work for a long, long, long time.
Although China has seen staggering growth over the past 3 decades, unemployment is a big problem here, in part because the ranks of educated workers are swelling. John is a 27-year-old engineer who asked to withhold his Chinese name because he feared even discussing American politics could get him in trouble with the government here. John said landing a job remains tough. Even the master's degree he received a few years back didn't help much.
Postgraduate student, it's hard to find a job.
John says unemployment isn't just a problem for the U.S. and President Obama. It's a problem the whole world faces. Overall, people found President Obama's tone on China more measured.
Candy, there's some jobs that are not going to come back.
And Stella Xie thought Romney's criticisms suggested he'd be harder for China to work with.
I think it more reflects like his, you know, ingrained mistrust with China. And I think for future, like if China and the U.S., we both want to grow our economy, there has to be trust.
Others thought Mr. Romney's attacks were more designed to win the election. Andrew Leo, an accountant in the finance industry and a Romney supporter, thought the Republican nominee would take a more practical approach and try to enhance business with China once he makes it to the White House.
Traditionally, Republicans are focused on the economy and are more pragmatic. When it comes to U.S.-China relations, they attach more importance to trade.
In the end, everybody seemed to enjoy the debate. They especially like seeing ordinary citizens question the people who want to lead them about the most pressing issues of the day. It's something they all said they wish they could do here in China. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
Coming up, a close-up of a death in Syria and a little-known vintage from France. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The numbers coming out of Syria can be mind-numbing. Hundreds of thousands of refugees, tens of thousands dead. Weeks ago, the conflict in Syria earned the dubious honour of being more violent than the worst days of the war in Iraq. NPR's Kelly McEvers now tells us just one of the stories behind those numbers.
When Syrians first started protesting in March of last year, Fadi Zeidan was there. He and his friends thought the Syrian uprising would be fast, like the ones in Tunisia and Egypt. Then Fadi was detained and beaten three times. He managed to get released and keep up his activist work. He shot, assembled, and uploaded videos of protests and later videos of battles fought by men who'd taken up arms to fight against government forces. Fadi eventually left Syria. These days, he still disseminates videos from the inside.
All the time we receive the videos from all the town and city, and we work on it to send the video to the channels and the news agency.
Every day, Fadi sits and watches dozens of gruesome videos, like this one that came across his desk a few weeks ago. It's a crude minute. A shaky camera shows the dead bodies of a dozen or so men on a black and white tile floor. A piece of paper with a number is attached to each body's chest. Other men mill around, peering at the faces of the dead. Curious, perhaps, trying to find a friend. One man wails in agony. Fadi played the video a few times, but he didn't look too closely. Then, as always, he sent the link around. A few hours later, the phone rang.
At 5 o'clock, my mother called me.
Fadi's mother is still in Syria.
She asked me first, are you alone? I said no. Are you with your friend? I said yes, Yani. I'm with my friend.
Good, she said. I'm sending you a link by Facebook. You must watch it. It was the same video Fadi had seen earlier in the day. But this time, he looked closer. He focused on the faces of the dead men. Fadi realized one of the dead men was his father. He had a bullet hole in his head.
What did you do when you realized it? I mean, we...
And all the time we work on this media, on this videos. But when I'm seeing my father in this video, I'm freeze.
You just froze. You froze.
Fadi's mother told him 2 days before his father had been detained by security forces. His body was later tossed in the street. Activists found him, shot the video, buried him and the other dead men, and sent word to Fadi's family. Residents in Fadi's area say his father is one of hundreds of people who've been executed in recent months. Fadi says the whole thing is still unreal. He says his family has decided to put off their mourning until their work is done.
Now I'm not afraid if I die, I'm not afraid, Yani, because all of us is the same, Yani. All the people need freedom, and all the people work to take it.
So for now, Fadi will keep sending out videos, sometimes going back to Syria to shoot the videos. And his father, Mohedin Zeidan, will remain another number, a 55-year-old man, a lawyer, killed in September 2012. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Beirut.
When you think of Paris, you might think of drinking a glass of wine there, perhaps a Burgundy or a Bordeaux. But it turns out the French capital has its own vintage. High on the hills of the neighbourhood of Montmartre is the last working vineyard in Paris, as NPR's Eleanor Beardsley explains.
Every year for a week in October, residents from the Paris neighbourhood of Montmartre pour into the streets to celebrate their grape harvest, known as the Fête des Vendanges. There is a costume parade, street performances, concerts, and giant picnics, all in honor of a small patch of land on a slope surrounded by houses with mansard roofs, a leafy plot the size of a city block whose dark purple Gamay and Pinot Noir grapes produce 1,000 bottles of red wine a year. The gates of Montmartre's vineyard, known as Clos Montmartre, are open for visitors in October. Head winemaker Francis Gourdin is giving a tour.
Les vignobles urbains existent.
Urban vineyards like this one, and also famous ones in places like Barcelona or Cape Town, are a sort of conservatory of a city's culture and history.
Oui, tout à fait. Parce qu'il y avait un projet d'immeuble ici.
The vineyard was born in the 1920s, Gourdin tells his listeners, when a group of well-known artists living here wanted to block a real estate project. So they planted grapevines. And under French law, nothing can be built on a vineyard. The first harvest came in 1933. Clos Montmartre is not a great wine, says Gourdin, but it's a respectable one.
Mais si, mais vous allez la conserver.
Amongst Gourdin's group this morning are visitors from as far away as Norway and Mexico, and Parisians like Arthur Assadourian.
I know many places in Paris, but Montmartre is unique because of the life which was here in the past. I mean the painters, the atmosphere, and this atmosphere that existed in the past. I can find it, for instance, in this vineyard. It's very special.
Vineyards covered much of this hilly part of Paris up until the 18th century. They diminished with industrialization and were completely wiped out in the late 1800s by the phylloxera epidemic. Today, Montmartre, like the rest of France, is replanted with American vine stock. After Montmartre's grapes are harvested, they're brought down to the basement of the town hall here in the 18th arrondissement, where they're pressed, fermented, and bottled.
So you can smell the wine.
Donc il y a environ 1000 bouteilles.
Town hall employee Olivia Bissiau explains that this is the only government office in Paris to make wine. The half bottles, which are considered collector's items, sell for $50 each, she says, and all the proceeds go to charity. Children are always a part of the Montmartre Fête des Vendanges. Every October, the streets of Montmartre become an open-air market with gastronomic specialties from every corner of France. And bien sûr, everything on the menu marries well with a bottle of Montmartre Rouge. Damien Compomas is selling his cheese and sausage from the French Alps.
And this is sausage from Savoie. You want to try sausage?
This crowd sings nostalgic songs as the 79th Vendange Festival winds to a close. The next time you visit Paris, be sure to head up to Montmartre for a good time and a glass of fine city wine. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.